Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I'm here on behalf of Mr. Andrus on this appeal. And as the court knows, Fifth Amendment issues were raised, and but recently I was advised to be ready to discuss the United States Supreme Court's recent decision in Fellers involving a Sixth Amendment issue. So I'd like to start by addressing the Sixth Amendment issue and its implications in this case. The Sixth Amendment, of course, protects an individual's right to counsel during critical stages of the proceedings and when proceedings have commenced. Now, I suggest that proceedings commence when an investigation turns to an accusation. And that's significant in this case, because in this case, we have a situation where Mr. Andrus was taken from the scene of a crime, given a statement in a car to the police, taken to the police station in his robe, underwear, socks, was given, was demanded to give a written statement, and he gave a written statement. And at that point, the versions differ. You have the affidavit and testimony of Mr. Earhart, whose involvement in this case became aware after the appeal was affirmed. And in that case, or in that, his testimony, his sworn testimony and affidavit, was that he received a call from Mr. Andrus from the Newcastle County Police Department stating that he had just given a written statement and that he was going to be charged with hindering prosecution, and he didn't know what to do. And Mr. Earhart, again, sworn testimony, spoke to Detective McLaren stating, do not question this gentleman, and he repeated it on a number of occasions, and then he repeated it on another phone call to Robert O'Neill, and I think to Detective Hetrick. So I would suggest at the point where, and according to Mr. Earhart, he was advised by McLaren that Andrus was going to be arrested for hindering prosecution. Now, he hadn't officially been arrested, but the intent was there. And I suggest that the timing of the arrest doesn't affect the fact that there was going to be proceedings against Mr. Andrus at the time, that prior to the two later recorded statements. So that's significant because it implicates the Sixth Amendment under the Fellers decision. And when Fellers distinguished between the Sixth Amendment and Fifth Amendment a right, the Fifth Amendment is the right against compulsion. The Sixth Amendment is the right to an attorney in adversarial proceedings. And the interrogation under both constitutional rules is not interchangeable. Under Fellers and under the Sixth Amendment, the Constitution prohibits deliberately eliciting a statement from somebody when there's going to be the proceedings, adversarial proceedings. And that's what happened in this case. After the written statement, and after McLaren formed in his mind that he was going to arrest Andrus for hindering prosecution, and after he advised Earhart that he was going to arrest Andrus for hindering prosecution, they then did elicit further statements, recorded statements. So in that way,
what preceded the elicitation of the statements after the police were told not to talk to him? What was the next event? Did they go back and talk to him and said, tell us, how did that come about?
According, it depends on who you believe, but According to Earhart, he received the call from Andrus. Andrus said he just gave the written statement, and he was going to be arrested for hindering prosecution. Earhart then said, let me talk to McLaren. McLaren says he's got to cooperate. We're going to arrest him for hindering prosecution. Earhart says, don't talk to him anymore.
Let's assume that he invoked his right to counsel because he talked to his attorney on the telephone.
Yes.
So he called his attorney.
Yes.
Then his attorney talked to the police and perhaps the prosecutor. There's a line of cases about how you start questioning someone again. And generally speaking, the person who's the suspect has to initiate the questioning with the police. Is the record clear on how the subsequent questioning evolved?
Subsequent to the written statement or the oral recorded statements?
Everything after he talked to his attorney on the telephone, those subsequent statements.
There was the first recorded statement without Miranda. There was the second recorded statement a half an hour later with Miranda.
What initiated those statements? I think that's what I was trying to get at.
I'm not clear on that. In our view, it was done in violation of Mr. Earhart's direction not to discuss it with Mr. Andrus. We do know that prior to those statements, the co-defendant Fogg had made statements.
But is there any indication in the record, knowing that Andrus might be charged with hindering prosecution, that notwithstanding the fact that he talked to his attorney, Andrus said to the police, I'd like to tell you the truth, and I don't want to get arrested for hindering prosecution, therefore I'll give another statement. Is that in the record anywhere?
I can't say that that's in the record. I can't tell you it is or is not. I can tell you that McLaren, I suggest a threatening tone, told Andrus, there are holes in your statement. You need to clear this up. You're facing problems. And that's when he contacted Earhart, and Earhart gave his direction, don't talk to him. And not only gave that direction to McLaren, to another police officer and to DAG O'Neill.
This may be clear to everyone else, but it isn't quite to me. On page 5, you say there are 4 statements at issue. Do I understand you to argue that statements 1 and 2, the first oral statement in the car, and then the written statement given at police headquarters, are subject solely to a Fifth Amendment analysis, and then statements 3, the taped interview, which you just explained the genesis of, as I understand it, and then the second taped interview are subject to both the Fifth Amendment and a Sixth Amendment analysis. Is that correct?
That we're not dealing with the first 2 statements. We don't feel that he was under custodial interrogation for the statement in the car. And this was the position taken by Mr. Foley.
Well, your brief says they're an issue. Are they or are they not an issue, those first 2?
No, the second 2 are the ones that are an issue. I thought my brief made it clear that only the second 2 are an issue. Mr. Foley, in his motion to suppress and his direct appeal, only made the second 2 statements at issue.
All right, well, the brief does say there are 4 statements at issue, and it explains you unsuccessfully attempted to suppress those in a pretrial motion to suppress.
Okay.
I recklessly assumed that when you said on page 5 they were an issue, that in fact they were.
I'm sorry, I did not make that clear. I was focusing on the 2 oral statements, the 2 oral recorded statements that came after the written statement. So under Fellers, and the standards are different under both. The Fifth Amendment and the Sixth Amendment. So under Fellers, I respectfully suggest that statements were deliberately elicited after proceedings commenced. And when I say proceedings, I mean when the investigation turned from an investigation into a determination that charges were going to be lodged, even though they weren't officially processed until hours later. The determination was made, it was conveyed to Mr. Earhart, and Mr. Earhart, based on that, gave direction. Then you turn to the Fifth Amendment, and they're virtually identical issues, whether there's custodial interrogation. This was addressed in a motion to suppress, and the court's already addressed that, and I recognize that the court's decision is the law of the case, except for the fact that Mr. Earhart's involvement didn't become, we didn't become aware of that until after the appeal had been affirmed. When he learned about, when Mr. Foley had told him that the appeal had been denied and what the issues were, he said, well, I was involved. I explained that they weren't supposed to question him at all. And that's what started this process in this Rule 61. So to the extent that this constitutes newly discovered evidence or evidence which in the interest of justice ought to be considered, I think the Fifth Amendment issues ought to be reconsidered. Mr. Earhart, after all, is a member of the bar. He's given his sworn affidavit and he's testified in court. And the problem with Judge Cooch's decision is that he never addressed squarely the testimony of Mr. Earhart. He just blew it aside and said, I've already found that there was no custodial interrogation, therefore, whatever Mr. Earhart says really doesn't matter. Well, it does matter, because if Mr. Earhart if Mr. Earhart gives the direction at the time he said, then there can be no further questioning. And so I ask that the court, even though that there's been a previous decision in this case, reconsider based upon Mr. Earhart's involvement in this case. The next issue I'd like to address is the Rule 404 issue relating to the admission of the prior fight involving Andrus and the victim. Our position is it should not have been admissible for the basis of animus or identity, because there was no foundation to support the finding of animus. Animus must show that the person, that Andrus initiated the fight, that he was angry against the victim, that he had some animosity against the victim. There's none of that in the record. The only thing in the record is that there was a fight between these two gentlemen, and there was no evidence to support any finding or inference that Andrus had animus against the victim or initiated the fight against the victim. With that lack of evidence, how can the jury fairly find that it's admissible or it can be considered for animus? You can't. The details of the fight aren't there. This could have been a fight initiated by the victim. The victim was a drunk, and he may have just got the worst of it. So this was prejudicial to Andrus in a number of ways. Number one, it shows propensity for violence. Number one, it left the jury with the false impression that he started the fight, and since he started the fight, it's likely that, you know, he's the one that started the fight that led to his death. So the court, and then the court later on in the record finds it stated that he didn't think that there was any great animus between Billy and Andrus. So the court's own language contradicts the previous finding that it's admissible for animus. With respect to identity, I suggest that that's a false issue. The victim was in the person's house. Andrus was there. There's no doubt that Andrus was at the same location. So the issue of identity is really specious. And then the other issue is, well, the nature of the injuries. Well, the nature of the injuries don't tell you anything other than the fact that Andrus got the best of the fight in a fight that who knows who started, and we don't know the circumstances. But all that points that Andrus as being a violent person when we really don't know who started the fight. And for those reasons, we suggest that evidence should not have been admissible.
How about the limiting instruction? Was Mr. Foley ineffective in not getting a better instruction? And if so, does that meet the prejudice prong of the Strickland test?
Well, he was ineffective to the extent that he didn't direct the court that language should have been included that said that condition the finding of animus or identity or the nature of the injury on the fact that Andrus may have started the fight.
Well, let's assume that the instruction given was incorrect.
Yes.
Suggesting that it went only to identity, for
yes.
example. And let's assume that Foley was ineffective in not sharpening those issues the way you suggested and getting a better instruction.
Yes.
Does it meet the second prong of the Strickland test on prejudice?
Well,
wasn't there a lot of other evidence, for example?
Well, it is prejudicial because once a jury hears evidence that suggests a propensity for violence, it deprives a person of his presumption of innocence. When juries hear evidence of prior convictions, of prior bad behavior, of propensity for violence, it really deprives them of a presumption of innocence.
But are you suggesting that ipso facto meets the prejudice prong of Strickland?
I'm suggesting that that instruction led the jury to believe that, in fact, there was animus, there was identity, there was the nature of the injury.
But does that meet the prejudice prong of Strickland? Because you have to look at the entire case, the strength of the evidence, and so forth.
I suggest it does, Your Honor, because it influences the thinking of the jury. It poisons the jury towards the defendant because of the impact that if he did it before, he likely did it again. It shows the propensity. And when a jury hears propensity, everything else goes out the window. And so I suggest that it does meet prejudice regardless of the rest of the evidence because the jury hears, hey, this guy's a bad guy, he's violent, we're not going to give him, if it's a close case, we're not going to give him the benefit of the doubt. And this was a case where, it could have been, there were lesser included evidence to support lesser included offenses. This was just guys that got drunk and things got out of hand. There was more recklessness, more evidence consistent with manslaughter. But when you hear evidence that, hey, this guy beat him up before, he's a bad guy, there's the prejudice. And if it's not prejudicial under Strickland, I would suggest that the instruction itself was plain error, depriving Andrus of his fair trial rights. The next issue, if I can turn to Dr. Perlman, and this issue is extremely important because this case really came down to a battle of the experts about what caused death. Dr. Perlman said the victim bled to death based upon the beating. Dr. Hoffman, the board-certified pathologist, testified that, no, even though he suffered injuries, that those injuries would not have caused the death in and of itself, that there was only one fracture of the hyoid bone, that this gentleman who had a BAC over 0.20 and was a chronic alcoholic and easily bled, choked from bleeding and on his own vomit, related mostly to the fact of his intoxication. So the jury was left with two expert opinions. Therefore, the credibility of both experts was really important. And in this case, I think I've detailed how Dr. Perlman really finessed her credentials. She is not a board-certified pathologist, and she knows it, and the prosecutor knows it, and there are rigid requirements in order to be a board-certified pathologist from the American Board of Pathology, and I listed them, and I sent them forth in the brief. She has chosen not to do that. She has chosen to go to a mail order organization where you pay a fee and you're basically waived in except for a test that they send to you.
Mr. Monica, you're well into your rebuttal time. I don't know how far you want to go.
I'm sorry.
Using that up.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
You want to save the rest of your time?
I'll save it.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Williams?
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court, I'll try to address the issues in the same order that have been presented on the initial oral argument here. Turning first to the first argument about the suppression of the two tape statements, and we're talking about statements that were both audio recorded and videotaped. There were transcripts prepared as well. All of that information was introduced at the original pretrial evidence suppression hearing, in 1996, when the trial court decided these issues for the first time. On the direct appeal to this court, there was an issue raised about the suppression of those, or the lack of suppression of those two statements. This court affirmed the trial court's decision. The trial court decided that as to the first tape statement that began shortly after 12 noon on April 5th, 1995, that Mr. Andrus was not in custody, that was not a custodial interrogation. He was present at the police station, but he had voluntarily agreed to come to the police station. He was previously acquainted with Detective McLaren because Mr. Andrus had been a victim of a shooting approximately a year before, and McLaren apparently had some involvement in the investigation of that shooting.
Do we know where that statement fits into the phone call to Andrus' lawyer?
Well, that's the question that I think is open. The trial court said that it was immaterial under the trial judge's legal analysis as to whether Mr. Earhart's phone call was before or after the tape statements. And the judge said the reason for that was twofold. One, the first statement was not a custodial interrogation, and the judge's rationale for the second statement not being suppressible was that Mr. Andrus had received his Miranda rights and had waived his rights, that he was certainly, as an individual who was acquainted with the criminal justice system, he had, I think, three prior DUIs, that he could waive it.
But we know that maybe that will be a problem, because if, in fact, the conversation with his lawyer did occur, then if the lawyer has recited it accurately, Mr. Andrus was a focus of hindering prosecution. And if, in fact, he then invoked his right to counsel, he might not have just been able to waive it if the statement was initiated by the police rather than Mr. Andrus.
Well, I think that's certainly an open factual question. And what you had testimony. We had an evidentiary hearing on two different days on February 22nd of 2002. Mr. Earhart testified, Detective McLaren testified. Mr. Earhart's version is, as has already been related to the court. Detective McLaren, however, says he did not speak to Mr. Earhart on the occasion of the two tape statements on April 5th, 1995. There was apparently a conversation the next day when Mr. Earhart was in telephone contact with Robert O'Neill, a deputy attorney general. And that, I think, is significant. What Mr. McLaren, Detective McLaren, says, and he prepared a report 6 days after this on April 11, 1995, and that report is State's Exhibit 2 at the Rule 61 hearing. And in that report, he says that there were phone calls, but they occurred much later in the afternoon, that what occurred then was Mr. Andrus asked to contact his attorney. He told Detective McLaren who his attorney was, Mr. Earhart, who was representing him at that time, I think, on a third DUI offense. Detective McLaren says in a statement he gives the phone book, apparently the Wilmington phone book, to Mr. Andrus to look up the phone number. Detective McLaren in his report also writes down the phone number for Mr. Earhart. He states that Mr. Andrus called or attempted to call Mr. Earhart. It was a little before 4 p.m. on the afternoon, approximately 2 hours after the second tape statement had concluded. Mr. Earhart wasn't in at that time, but there was a subsequent conversation between Earhart and Andrus when Earhart later called back that afternoon. The state's position is that Mr. Earhart is simply mistaken about the timing of his particular telephone conversation with his client in this instance. What you have is conflicting testimony from two individuals. Now, how is this court or how is the trial court to resolve it if the trial court was going to decide credibility? Well, I think one of the important things to look at is the statements themselves. And if you look at the second tape statement, there's transcripts that have been prepared, and they were introduced at the suppression hearing. I think there are two statements in there made by Mr. Andrus that resolve the seeming conflict between the timing of the telephone calls. At the second page of that second statement, the one that starts at 1:05 p.m., it's explained to Mr. Andrus that the police are going to take a second statement. They had already taken an initial tape statement beginning approximately 12:04 p.m., and 25 minutes after that, the first statement really doesn't say a whole lot. The police decide if they're ever going to get to the bottom of what's happened at Mr. Andrus' house, they're going to take a second statement. So they explain that to Mr. Andrus. Mr. Andrus then says, I get to call my attorney then if you're going to do all that. And there's a question mark. And I think that's indicative of the fact that there hasn't been any conversation with his attorney. He says, I get to call my attorney then if you're going to do all that. Now, later on in the second tape statement, at page 33 of the transcript, they're explaining that he really hasn't explained what happened at the house. He goes through a lot of potential explanations that he went to bed, he woke up, he didn't really know what happened. They found Mr. Dilley dead in the bathtub. The statement is then made by Mr. Andrus. After you talk to the witnesses, and the police are explaining, Detectives McLaren and Watson, that they're interviewing other witnesses about this particular homicide as well. And Andrus says, after you talk to the witnesses, officer, I can call my lawyer then. If you guys weren't friendly, I'm telling you, I didn't see anybody do it. So I think those two statements are indicative of the fact that there hasn't been any telephone conversation between Mr. Andrus and Mr. Earhart at that particular time. And I think if you're going to have to resolve credibility one way or the other, look at this third additional piece of evidence here, the statements themselves. I think those statements, a fair reading of those particular comments, are that there has not been a conversation between Earhart and Andrus at the time of the second statement. In this particular case, I think Mr. Earhart is simply mistaken about the timing here. Mr. Earhart prepares an affidavit. It's a September of 2001. The trial court mistakenly says 2002, but it's 2001. Now, that affidavit is prepared 6.5 years after all of this occurs. At the Rule 61 hearing, Mr. Earhart was asked, do you have any written notes? He said he had written notes about the conversation. Do you have any written notes? He said, no, he didn't have his written notes now. He was then asked, do you have any time records that would indicate that you had some involvement in the Andrus matter on April 5, 1995, that you're not confused about the day or whenever this occurred? He said he didn't have any time records either. What he bases this recollection on 6.5 years after the event is he goes back and looks at his computer calendar as to what appointments he had that day. And on that basis, he says, oh, yeah, I remember now. I had this appointment at 9 o'clock. I had to go to court at 11. When I came back, the sun was shining. It came in on the east side of the building. And I remember it was around 11 a.m. that this occurred. Well, the state submits that the contrary testimony of McLaren is more believable here, and it's certainly supported by what Mr. Andrus himself says in his own second statement. McLaren says, no, no, these phone calls occurred that day, but they occurred at approximately 4 p.m. here. McLaren prepared a written report 6 days, not 6.5 years, 6 days after this occurred. That report was present at the suppression hearing. That report was introduced by the state at the Rule 61 hearing. I think it's curious, and the trial judge thinks it's curious too, I submit, when he says in footnote 21 at his decision that's attached as Exhibit C to the state's answering brief at page 5, he says, this is a quote, it's unclear from the record why Mr. Earhart did not promptly determine the identity of counsel representing Andrus in an effort to inform counsel that Andrus had called Mr. Earhart when the police were investigating Billy's homicide, a fact which now forms the basis of one of Andrus's Rule 61 claims. And the state's
as I understand the record, the trial judge never made a factual determination. What the trial judge appears to have said is, even if Earhart talked to Andrus at 11 in the morning, it doesn't matter. But wouldn't you agree that if the trial judge made a factual finding that Earhart did talk to him at 11 in the morning, it would matter?
Well, I think it probably would. He says, the trial judge says, the first statement is a non-custodial interrogation. He's not in custody, so it may not make any difference then. Just because the lawyer says don't talk to somebody if they're not in custody, I don't think the trial or the attorney can blanketly prohibit the police from investigating a homicide in that respect. However, when he is in custody, that's when we're talking about the Fifth Amendment being triggered. When formal proceedings are instituted, that's when the Sixth Amendment is triggered, and that's what the Fellers case says here. We don't have a situation as we had in Fellers, which was post-indictment and where Mr. Fellers was actually being arrested. He hadn't been arrested at the time of either statement. He's arrested on the hindering prosecution charge after the second statement's concluded. He isn't arrested on the homicide until 2 days later.
So you don't accept defense counsel's argument that it would be a slippery slope to worry over the timing of an arrest, because the police can always manipulate the timing of the arrest. What's important was, when was it their intent to arrest?
Well, I think I would agree with that.
When was there, in your construction of the facts surrounding the different statements, whether they're on that only two in issue or four, when does the record support an intent to arrest?
Well, the trial judge says he thinks there's an intent to arrest when the last taped statement begins. He thinks that the police, at least in their mind, have formed some sort of subjective intention that if Mr. Andrus doesn't provide some better explanation to what's happened in his house, that he's going to be arrested. Now, he doesn't actually get arrested till after the statement. And the trial judge, that's his particular finding.
Are you talking about being arrested for the homicide or being arrested for hindering prosecution?
Being arrested for hindering prosecution. And that's all he's arrested for on April 5th. It's not until 2 days later, And it's important that there's a time break here, because what happens in the interim is that Dr. Perlman, whose professional credentials have been attacked here, she does the autopsy on April 6th. During the autopsy, she finds what she describes as patterned injuries on the body, injuries that were inflicted by rings and certain boots or shoes. She asked the police on April 6th if they collected any jewelry or footwear from either of these two individuals, Fogg or Andrus, and it's only after she's able to match up some of the cuts on Mr. Dilley's face to the ring that Mr. Andrus had that the police then arrest him. They also later find out that the cowboy boots, podiatrist says, those boots are the same boot, or have the same size as Mr. Andrus's feet. So I think that's all important. But ultimately here, what's significant is the posture of this case. This is not a direct appeal. What this is an appeal from a denial of post-conviction relief. We're at the stage now where you have to show something that's going to overcome the procedural bars. Most all of these claims are barred either by Superior Court Criminal Rule 61I3 because they were not presented on the direct appeal, and you have to show cause and prejudice to excuse that procedural default, or in the case of the suppression issue, they were presented in one form and they are now barred by 61I4 as being previously adjudicated. Now, in order to escape these procedural bars, you have to overcome the finding that these things should be as they are, unless you can fit within one of the exceptions or you can show prejudice. For the showing of ineffective assistance of counsel, there's also a two-part test under Strickland that you have to show that counsel did not meet the reasonable standard of normal counsel here. And second, most important, that you can show prejudice. And it's the state's bottom line position in all this that even if the trial judge is wrong, that these statements should have been suppressed and they should not have been heard by the jury, that ultimately, in this case, Mr. Andrus cannot show prejudice to meet the second prong of Strickland. Williams versus Taylor, a later United States Supreme Court case, says that prejudice in this context means a reasonable probability of a different result at trial. If you take the two statements out, and the state's position is that neither one of these statements is particularly incriminatory of Mr. Andrus. And Mr. Andrus, I think, recognized that fact because in his original suppression motion, he argues that, well, the reason I got arrested for hindering prosecution was because I wouldn't confess to the crimes. So his view of his own statements was they weren't a confession, and the trial judge pointed out in deciding the suppression hearing issue back in 96, after conducting the suppression hearing and deciding the suppression motion in 96, that no, you weren't arrested because you didn't confess to the homicide. You were arrested because you had destroyed or at least put evidence away that couldn't be readily found. There was a blanket that Mr. Dilley was wrapped in or a comforter that was later found outside the residence, and the DNA matched Dilley's blood that was found on the comforter. That was the reason. The statements themselves are not particularly incriminatory. I went through the statements in detail. The first statement, these are two tape statements, really doesn't say much of anything. Mr. Andrus, in this particular case, in this appeal, he doesn't really point to anything.
So
it's all incriminatory.
Keep your voice down just a little
bit. I'm sorry.
You have a cold, I know. You're trying to talk over your cold.
I'm sorry. He doesn't really point to anything in particular that's all that incriminatory at either statement. What he does is he says that these statements were utilized by Detective Watson in his trial testimony, and he discussed every inconsistency in the defendant's statements. Now, the appendix to the opening brief here, pages 111 through 115, it lists these five inconsistencies that Detective Watson discussed at trial. The state's position is that none of these are particularly significant, and they're certainly not truly incriminatory. There's a inconsistency about whether or not Mr. Andrus was at Steve's Tavern at 11 a.m. on the day before the homicide, April 4th. What that proves in terms of the homicide, I have no idea. Second question is whether there was fighting at the party on April 4th, the party at Andrus's house. And the point is that the statement by Andrus, where he only discusses some fighting between his co-defendant, Mr. Fogg, and another guest at the party, Dwayne Kothel, that that's inconsistent with some statement that Cheryl Andrus, another witness, made. But that's talking about something that happened earlier in the day when Cheryl Andrus leaves Andrus's house at approximately 11 p.m. that evening. There are three people present: Fogg, Andrus, and Dilley. She leaves, leaving those three individuals. There's no fighting at that particular point. She says Mr. Dilley's in the front room trying to get a fire started in a wood stove. The third inconsistency deals with a statement where Andrus says that Dilley had argued with a few boys during the day of the party, and that is inconsistent with other evidence. Now, whether he had argued with other people or not doesn't prove that Mr. Andrus committed a homicide, certainly. The fourth inconsistency is that Mr. Andrus didn't acknowledge striking Dilley during an April 4 argument. What had occurred was there was apparently a fight or an argument in the basement between Fogg and Kothel. Dilley had originally intervened to try to break that fight up, and then Mr. Andrus intervenes, and in the process, he pushes Dilley out of the way and hits Dilley in the face. That is the incident that's referred to. Again, that's not indicative or certainly not a basis for the jury to find that he committed a homicide and they killed Mr. Dilley later that evening or the next morning. The final inconsistency is that Andrus said that women, plural, accompanied he and Fogg back to the residence, and that's inconsistent with what Cheryl Andrus said. She said she was the only person there. Well, again, that's not of any major significance. It's certainly not incriminatory. The state's position is that neither one of these statements is particularly incriminatory of Mr. Andrus. And when you actually look at the various statements that are made by Mr. Andrus during the interrogation, there are numerous claims of innocence here. He says at page 10, so evidently it was somebody in the house earlier that evening, later that evening, I don't know. Page 14, he says, I didn't do it. Page 15, he says he went upstairs. Then he says, if there was more after that, I don't know. Page 22, he says, I didn't have anything to do with this stuff, nothing. Page 35, I can't tell you who did it. And finally, near the very end of the 46-page statement of page 44, he says, I don't know what happened. Most importantly, I think, at page 37 of this statement, this is very near the end of the last taped statement, the police ask Mr. Andrus, would you be willing to take a polygraph today to resolve this matter? And Mr. Andrus says, yeah. Now, if the jury hears that, how possibly incriminatory is that to Mr. Andrus? He's denied repeatedly that he had anything to do with it. He says he doesn't know what's happened. He's asked by the police, are you willing to take a polygraph today? And he says, yeah, I'm willing to do that. The state's position is that even when viewed in toto, these two recorded statements of Andrus, even if they were improperly admitted, do not incriminate the accused or significantly contribute to the guilty verdicts. In order to show prejudice under Strickland and Williams, you have to show a reasonable probability of a different result. Mr. Andrus was convicted not on the basis of these two taped statements. He was convicted on the basis of the pattern injuries, the physical evidence that was found on the body, and the highly incriminatory testimony by Robert Richmond, where Andrus essentially confessed to the crime in prison to this other inmate, Robert Richmond. That was the evidence that convicted Mr. Andrus in this particular case. I only have a couple of minutes left, so I'll respond briefly to the other arguments. Dr. Perlman, she's certainly qualified to give an opinion. You're not required to be board certified by any particular board. She didn't misrepresent which board she was certified by. She said she was certified in forensic medicine. She's been a medical examiner in both Philadelphia and Delaware for many years. And all of this simply goes to the weight of the testimony. There's not a remarkable disagreement about the pattern injuries with Dr. Hoffman, the defense pathologist, only that Dr. Hoffman says he can't be 100% certain or you can't say to a high degree of certainty. Well, that's not really the standard. The standard is a reasonable medical probability or a reasonable medical certainty. So he was actually elevating the evidentiary standard here, but he doesn't say that, you know, he can completely discount the pattern injuries here. He just said he's not comfortable saying to a high degree of certainty, whatever that means. The other thing, the 404B evidence, I think that was properly admitted. The trial court judge did the six-part Getz analysis. He gave a proper limiting instruction here to the jury, and it was introduced for proper purposes as recognized under the evidentiary rule here, 404B. We haven't addressed the other altercation 2 weeks earlier. And I haven't gone through the specific instances of the defense counsel's ineffectiveness in the last argument, but I think the point to be made in all of those is, again, that you don't have to even look at the reasonableness of counsel's conduct, trial counsel and counsel on direct appeal, if you can't find prejudice here. And the state's position is there's no showing of a reasonable probability of a different result. The physical evidence, the pattern injuries on the body that are attributable directly to Andrus's ring and Andrus's cowboy boots, and the highly incriminatory admissions that Andrus made to Robert Richmond that were testified to at trial, that's what convicted him. Even if you take all of these other matters out of the trial, he still would have been convicted of first-degree homicide. If there are any additional questions, I'll attempt to answer those. I'm sorry for raising my voice.
Yes, sir. Mike.
You can't minimize the impact of inconsistent statements. Inconsistent statements show deceit. Deceit obviously has an impact on a view of the defendant. And it was so significant in this case that the state emphasized the inconsistent statements during its case in chief over the defendant's objection and then made a big deal about it in the closing statement. So it's inaccurate to suggest that it had minimum impact. The state in trial made a significant decision to emphasize that. With respect to the boots and the rings and the patterns, the conclusions by Dr. Perlman, the FBI looked at the same material and found that that information was inconclusive. And in fact, the boots from Mr. Andrus, there was no blood on those on the boots. The FBI didn't find that the patterns, that there was conclusive evidence that the patterns on the victim's body were consistent with the Andrus's boots or the ring. This was Dr. Perlman, and again, this goes to her credibility. And the last issue this summer, Culp v. Texas, was announced by United States Supreme Court, and that relates to custodial, when a person is in custody. And I suggest that that decision, if you apply that, the circumstances are virtually identical to this case. And when you apply Culp v. Texas and then you apply the Earhart, those are new circumstances that give a basis for reconsideration of the issues that were raised. Regarding the credibility between Earhart and McLaren, McLaren made a report 6 days later. In that report, his details were wrong about the timing of the oral statement. I note that in the brief. He had wrong details, and he testified. He doesn't even recall talking to Mr. Earhart. Mr. Earhart's testimony, if you read his testimony, he is certain about the circumstances of his conversation. And then lastly, Colleen Norris testified. She appeared at the police station around noon when Andrus was there and was being questioned. And I asked her, she was aware were you aware that Mr. Earhart had called? She said, I think the quote was, I may have been aware of it. I may not have been aware of it. She didn't rule it out.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer.
I think that's significant.
Thank you.